system online. Initiate transfer protocol. Your turn next.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Your Turn Next. I am here today with Reese.
Hey, guys.
And with Ryan.
How are you?
And we don't have Tony with us today. He has taken a week off, but we've got a good show for you, hopefully. And we're going to start it off by talking a little bit about the last Clockwork Phoenix article, which was Stay on Target. And in that article, I talked a little bit about how target audiences for games, and tangentially also for books or short stories or movies, can be fairly narrow or can be broader. Also, how you should keep in mind who your target audience is, because it's very easy to miss the mark if you're just kind of doing things the way that you feel like doing them instead of thinking about the people that you're making the product for and trying to reach.
So, DC, do you think it's better to have like a target audience and have things really detailed to a select few, or would you think it's better to have a broader audience and try to include as many as possible? Or does it just depend on the game or genre or whatever?
It depends a lot, I think, on the circumstances and on what you're trying to accomplish. One of the things that I said at the very end of the article is that sometimes people try to make their audience so broad, they actually lose the audience they were trying to hit. And I think we've seen that happen on occasion in gaming, where people have this idea and have kind of an audience in mind, but then they make it almost too accessible, and their original target audience doesn't find the game fun anymore. I think that's something that can happen when you're known for a particular genre and start stepping outside of it. It can be hard to kind of break into family games if you're considered a tactical game company, or to break into hardcore strategy games if you're known for light, fluffy, fun stuff. I also think that artwork can have a lot to do with it. Certainly, you can get an impression of who a target audience is from the artwork that may or may not hold up well in terms of how that links into the story or the gameplay. All of it has to be viewed as one, because if you have the pieces too separated, people can kind of get off track from each other. I remember in particular a game that was just kind of a light and fluffy, fun card game, but the artwork for it was like really grim black and white stuff with undertakers and nooses. And it's like, this doesn't really fit. Or the opposite, like where you've got a game with like just cute little sheep or farm animals or something, but it's really got a lot of rules and a lot of depth to the gameplay, a lot of setup time. It's like no one expects to spend 4 hours playing a deep, convoluted game about farm animals. That you expect it to be just light, fluffy, fun, 30 minutes or less type of thing.
Well, in a way, it's like a lot of the components kind of add up to what you're thinking you're going to get from the game. Mm-hmm. So, like, you see that kind of a thing, and it's not that it's, you just wouldn't expect it to be that way. So, in a way, you do kind of formulate it according to who you're thinking would like it.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that a lot can be said with the message. Like, it's almost false advertising. Like, I just recently played, was it Super Dungeon Explorer? And
yeah.
I was completely surprised by the complexity. I got into it like, oh, this is a 4-hour game, easy. And we actually stopped playing because we expected it to just be an hour or two and be done. I was shocked, actually.
Now, I will say that Super Dungeon Explorer goes quicker once people really know the rules.
Mm-hmm.
Like, there's a lot of games that kind of have a learning curve to them, but then the game can go a lot quicker. Like, there's
mm-hmm.
plenty of games out there the first time that I've tried them out took a whole lot longer than future times. But it also depends slightly on factors like, what you're drinking, for example. Reese is giving me that knowing look.
No.
Maybe some Space Cadets.
Oh, yeah,
that
was intense.
That should have taken like an hour and a half.
So,
how long did we play that
so
game?
So much booze. It's just, I don't know why we tried playing a game. I'm not sure.
Yeah, it kind of got away from us.
A little bit.
But when you open up that box and there's tons and tons of components, things to punch out, a nice thick rule book, you expect a certain experience, especially if the visuals of the game back that up. But if you lift up the lid and here's a bunch of little cute sheep on poker chips, then you expect something very different, where it's just kind of a lighter type of game. I do really appreciate it, though, when people can broaden their own audience. Mentioning the 32 poker chips of sheep is actually the game Battle Sheep. And I think it's actually 64. But whatever. Some number of poker chip sheep and some little tiles that make up the pasture. It's pretty easy to play. You can explain that game in a minute to somebody. Even fairly young kids, I'm sure, can figure out how to move the sheep around the pasture on the board. But it's also got some fairly decent strategy to it. In a two-player game, you certainly want to start staking your claim, having areas of the board that you're in control of, and you can see that when people first try it, usually the more experienced player will win, but eventually people start picking up on, well, what's the best way to kind of corner the other guy, block in their sheep, and of course in multiplayer, three or four player games, it very quickly becomes a game of diplomacy as well as a game of sheep positioning. So I think it's a good way to, they hit their target audience, but they also have enough there for board gamers, and it's almost even a very light miniatures game in a sense, because it has all these positional elements where you're trying to move the sheep and how you can control portions of the battlefield.
So in this case specifically, are you saying that they've done it well because even though it's kind of like cutesy and like childish, it also like does appeal to adults in a way because of the like strategy involved?
Yeah, absolutely. Like I think they hit their target audience just fine. And if you look at kind of the rest of that company's game line, it's mostly for kind of a younger audience and very like bright colors, a lot of big pieces. But the fact that, for example, like a mom and dad could play this with a couple of kids, but then later on the kids go to bed, the mom and dad could play it against each other and have kind of a more tactical game, like planning out several moves ahead. How do I block off this area of the pasture before you can start putting your sheep there? That kind of thing. It hits on a number of levels. And so then, of course, the best way to then spread the game is through telling people about it. So I played this game where I wasn't even really the target audience, but now I'm telling you guys about it on a podcast. And so more people will hear, oh, hey, Battle Sheep isn't just a game for kids or whatever. It's also got some tactics to it. Not along the same lines of a big hobby miniatures game or something, but enough meat to the game that we would enjoy playing it together. Can you think of any examples, Ryan, where you think a company has hit their target audience well, but also kind of included other types of gamers in the experience?
I think Dominion's a pretty good example.
Yeah.
It's a great, easy to learn. Like you said, it can take 5 minutes to actually sit down and learn that game, but there's the experienced player is usually going to figure out there's an engine on the board and run it, whereas the new players are going to just try to play what they have. I think it's a perfect example of that.
Yeah, I think Dominion and a lot of deck building games can have that wider appeal. Well, and some games, thinking about licensed games, a lot of their target audience is very built in. So when you say, okay, well, here's this new board game in the Marvel universe or something, your target audience should be the people who already like Marvel stuff, whether that's the comics or the movies or even the toys. You know what your potential target audiences are, and maybe there's even a way to hit multiples of those. Like, that's the ideal, I think, is to use that licensing to its fullest potential, if you can.
Definitely. And I think, especially with the licensed game, if you make a decent game on top of already hitting your target, you're going to bring in real gamers. It's the same example you're saying. Once people start talking about it, you're going to get the players that want depth of strategy and a real game to come and sit down and be like, okay, this is fun, on top of its characters that I want to play with.
But at the same time, you have a lot of potential to do the opposite. If you miss your original target audiences, you're going to lose them and anyone they could potentially bring into the game, their friends who like different styles of games. I've seen that a lot with electronic games. Like when a new video game comes out with some IP that's on it, some setting or characters, people immediately start looking at it as, well, does this truly feel like the experience that I want? Does it give me the immersion that I want to have? Because when people see those characters, they're like, all right, well, I want to feel like the characters in the game. And some games do a much better job of putting you in that driver's seat of those personalities and those fighting styles than others do.
I actually recently randomly picked up a Walking Dead, really inexpensive card game, and it ran into the same problem you were talking about earlier, where the theme didn't fit the mechanics. It was really just a numbers game. It had nothing to do with fighting zombies or surviving the apocalypse. And I've played it once, and I just walked away from it because, like, okay, it didn't have that immersion that I was looking for. I wanted it to feel like I was battling zombies in the apocalypse, and it felt like I was playing Uno. So it's just the two don't mesh well.
Yeah, it's definitely a danger. Kind of the more well-known the property is, the more danger is there. Because, like, if I'm playing some card game and it's got Cyclops and Wolverine and Storm, for example, I know what those characters are supposed to play like. And so it puts an even higher expectation than if it's just, like, new superhero, this guy made up number 1, 2, and 3. Like, you don't really know how those characters are supposed to be, so you're more forgiving of it. But when you have kind of a knowledge and a basis where, oh, this is how this is supposed to feel, who this is supposed to behave like, you have a much higher bar set for the person making the game.
And I think you can also get to the point where you were talking about with the IP issue is if you make a game that's too gamer specific that still has an IP on it, you're going to alienate the casual gamer instantly. If you make it too difficult, people are gonna, I can't play this, I don't understand it, and walk away. It's not something I could pick up and play with my girlfriend type of a thing. And right there, you've lost any audience, really. You've lost your target audience plus the potential gamers that would walk in from word of mouth.
Yeah, so if you've got, like, the Minions license, for example, don't make the next Twilight Imperium.
Exactly. That's a perfect analogy.
Have you played the Gears of War board game?
I haven't.
Have you played the Gears of War video game?
Yes.
Reese,
there was an actual glow that shined down from heaven on Reese. I don't know if you guys could hear the glow, but it was there.
Me and my cousin play, like, the endless, like, waves of, like, enemies, and just, like, for hours, and we'll just sit there and just keep playing until they finally kill us. Like, just stay as long as possible, don't eat, just sitting there drinking sodas, fishing, like, ugh. I love that game. Favorite are the boomers, though. The ones that are like, boom, and they, like, make this, like, stupid sound. And, like, you always know where they are, because they just yell boom all the time.
Oh. The reason I brought up Gears of War is because the board game, I've played it with a variety of people. I played it with gamery people who just like dungeon crawl board games, and I've also played it with people who like the Gears of War setting. And like Reese was talking about, they like to just hang out for hours and blow up the bad guys in the video game.
Sorry, it's just fun. It's just really fun.
And I think that the board game does a pretty good job of being both. Like, it is a dungeon crawl. You've got to get to different points on the map. You've got to find different cards and that kind of thing, just like so many dungeon crawl type of games. And it successfully does that. But it also spawns a lot more bad guys than many dungeon crawls do. And your characters are fairly heroic.
It's funny that you bring that up, because I think while you say that it can bring in that audience of Gears of War players that want to play it, and it's more arcadey, you run into the issue of, like, the Diablo board game, where you can jump into a game of Diablo and be done completely with the experience within an hour, hour and a half, whereas the Diablo board game kind of alienates those players, because while they like the IP, you run into the issue of it being too long to set up, and it's an hour and a half before you start playing.
Oh, wow.
So you kind of are running a risk there of also alienating your target audience again.
Yeah, I haven't actually played the Diablo one, but it does seem like that would be a hard audience to hit with a board game.
Yeah, I mean, it's really hack and slash. It's really fast-paced. And like I said, you can play a whole dungeon run in a short amount of time, 2 hours at the long end. So it just seems you're really taking away that experience by transitioning it to another medium.
Yeah, I'm trying to think of a good board game that plays like that, where you are just, like, mulching bad guys and grabbing loot, but it's quick to set up and fun, and nothing's jumping to mind.
It seems like it'd be something hard to do, because the whole point of the point-and-click hack-and-slash is that there's endless hordes of enemies. In order to do that, you have to have endless pieces. So it seems like a very hard balance.
Have you guys played Munchkin, like the card game?
I have not. I've heard very good things, though.
Have you played the board game, DC?
I've not played the board game, only the card game.
So maybe I'm biased because I started out playing the card game, but I love that game. Like, I think it's amazing. Like, I think it actually, like, flows pretty smoothly, and you can kind of learn as you go, and once you have it, like, you can just play it. Drinks or not. Like, it's mm-hmm. it's a pretty fun game to play. And then I ended up trying the board game at some point later on, and it was, like, it just made it super clunky, and, like, there's more stuff to keep track of, but not for really any benefit. Like, there was nothing that it really added. To me, it just took away from it and made me not enjoy the game. And it was kind of like, oh, that's lame, because I feel like if I had tried the board game first, I don't think I would have liked it, and I might not have tried the card game. And maybe our listeners have different opinions on that, or maybe somebody who's played the board game before playing the card game, like, sees it differently. But I found, like, switching over to the board game, which wasn't how it was originally played, just made it not fun.
Yeah, that's interesting. I don't know if I would like the board game or not. I'm not a huge fan of the card game. It might have just been the experiences that I had playing it. I find other sort of dungeon crawly card games to be more fun, where you're finding weapons and loot and trying to level up and accomplish something first. I think there's a number of games out there that do that, and Munchkin wasn't my favorite.
You should try playing it with me, and then we'll, like, revisit it.
Yeah.
Because, like, it's pretty fun.
But then we'll have to play the other various dungeon crawl card games.
I'm cool with that. I'm okay with any new games. I'll try anything. I love games, so.
Do you like Boss Monster?
I don't think I've played that.
I love that game.
Yeah. I think they hit who they were trying to hit. I'm not a huge fan of that one either. I guess part of it for me is I want to feel like the choices that I'm making are impacting what's happening in the game. Not just, this is cool, so I'm going to do it, but this is something that will have an impact down the road, this decision I'm making right now.
Yeah, I think that particular game has a lot of screw your neighbor elements that kind of make it difficult to plan ahead.
Yeah. Well, yeah. And even just the luck of the draw in that game is very high. I find the luck of the draw in Munchkin very high. But there are people who love those kinds of games. I am certainly not saying that that whole genre is bad or something. It's just not my personal favorite.
So I have an example of maybe trying to, like, pinpoint a target audience so much that it might lose a lot for, like, the common player. It's this game that I've been playing called This War of Mine, I think it's called, and it's on Steam. It's really well done, but it is so depressing.
Like, yeah.
And it's difficult, and it's just like it just kind of, like, depresses you. Like, I don't even know how to, like, explain it, because it's engaging, but everything you do has an effect, and it's kind of, like, tries to be, like, real world during a war situation. Like,
well, and the graphics don't really scream that it's going to be like that.
Totally.
Like, they're kind of cartoony, and, like, one of the images they show is this like, fluffy dog that's running around. This looks like kind of a light sort of war game, but it is not. I haven't played, I've just heard, but
yeah, I haven't played it either, but I read a review that described it exactly like that, that it's an amazing, engaging, awesome experience, but don't play it because you'll cry.
Like, you have to be in the right frame of mind. Like, I haven't even gone through it, like, one, I guess, because my characters keep dying, and it is difficult, and you deal with, like, hunger and the cold and sickness and, like, all of, like, raiders and, like, all of these things while trying to, like, keep your humanity, basically, and not, like, kill people or, like, screw other people over, like, trying to do the right thing in a situation where it's, like, nobody's doing the right thing.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, your characters will get depressed and, like, even kill themselves if you, like, do too many things to make them not feel very human. Like, it's so, like, it's kind of stressful, but it's really good.
Yeah. I wonder if they chose the art they did to kind of tone down the darkness a little bit, to, like, dial back how depressing it is.
Maybe, but it's not working. Like,
it doesn't work?
It's, like, it's kind of intense.
Yeah.
It's like, it's a game. It's fine. But it's just like, huh.
That actually brings up an interesting point as far as target audience. Maybe it's possible they chose the art style they did to pull in a specific audience, to get the type of people that would feel that way about it and think about it differently. While it's like a style choice in order to get the type of people that would understand the message they were trying to portray.
Hmm. Yeah, that could be as well. That it wasn't to soften the impact, but to appeal to people that had the right emotional sensibilities.
Mm-hmm.
And games certainly use different art to target a different audience. What's that mobile game that all their ads are very kind of using the sex sells sort of method.
Game of War, I think.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah. They've got a target audience. So they've got like a swimsuit model and a chainmail bikini on a horse.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's the Spike TV audience. That's nailed it.
I don't know if the gameplay is actually hitting that audience very well or not. I mean, they had Super Bowl commercials. They must have money.
Yeah.
Like a decade ago, who would have thought that a game for a phone would have a Super Bowl commercial?
Yeah, it's astounding, really.
Yeah. The world is a changing place. Well, speaking of target audiences, we should talk a little bit, because it's a hot topic right now, because I've had people chatting with me about it on Facebook and other social media and stuff lately. Age of Sigmar. Reese has not played any edition of Warhammer Fantasy. So, Ryan, why don't you catch her up a little bit with a rundown of Warhammer Fantasy past and Age of Sigmar present?
Well, just to highlight the differences, I think the original Fantasy, or even maybe not the original, but the closer to the, like the 5th, 6th, 7th editions, were more geared towards a hardcore wargaming audience. It's more of the, almost when they first started pulling in the historical miniatures market, trying to get them into a fantasy game. And slowly over the years, they've made it more of like the quintessential fantasy miniatures game. And with the most recent edition, Age of Sigmar, I hesitate to use the word dumbed down. I think they simplified. I think that's a better word for it. They made it more accessible.
Okay.
And whether or not that's a good thing remains to be seen. That's the debate as of late about, are they alienating their original audience? I think DC hit the nail on the head saying that it's a move to inject new blood into the hobby. And I think that as a whole, that's a good thing for even for people outside of the Warhammer Fantasy game. For War Machine players, that's a whole new generation of kids that will come to this hobby. And to be honest, it is a dying hobby. I know I've talked to you, DC, recently that I can't get a game of War Machine in Ohio. The only person I can play with is my buddy Bob, who I'm letting play with my minis. So it's really hard. We need new blood in the market.
Yeah, I certainly think there are areas that are kind of like meccas of hobby wargaming, where there's big, thriving community, lots of stores, events almost every weekend. But then there's plenty of areas where it is just kind of dying off, where there aren't as many opponents, aren't as many stores as there used to be. And Age of Sigmar, I think, for a hobby miniatures game, it certainly has the simplest rule set of one that's certainly as known as it is. Most games that are that simple are just by little publishers or some guy doing a one-off or something. Like, I've seen a caveman miniatures game where the rules were probably shorter than Age of Sigmar. But most of the time, you look at your War Machine, your Infinity, Malifaux, even X-Wing. You've got a lot more core rules than they do. The entire core rules of the game are 4 pages. Not a lot of complexity there, but it's playable. It's not a game that I would personally enjoy, but it's simple enough to get people to be able to put miniatures down on the table and have a war. I do think it can be good for younger audiences, and I think they've got certain mechanics that some people have complained about a lot, other people have praised, but that are just kind of silly and are there just kind of for fun. Like, there's one guy where if you're playing that guy, and while you activate him, you pretend you're riding a horse. Like, you stand at the table and you gallop, you get a bonus on his rolls. Like,
that's actually kind of funny, though.
It is funny, yeah. And there's, I think, some dwarven guy or something that if you have a longer beard than your opponent, you get a bonus on his saves or something like that.
Red. I'd win that every time.
Yeah, beard one?
Yep.
Well, we have talked about our dwarven drinking games before.
Yeah, that's true. Well, I think that this whole thing is kind of a case of, when you buy these armies, they're kind of expensive, and like you put a lot into them, and like it becomes like a big part of your life. Like, this is a huge commitment to this hobby. And I don't think that you, like, at the beginning, you buy a lot of stuff. But as it goes on, you only buy stuff here or there. So it could also be, it's unfortunate that it's not, like, more complex and more, like, for the, like, already made fan base.
Right.
But with such a huge company, they have to get, like, constantly be getting new people to come in to, like, support how big their company is growing and getting to be. Like, they're going to need more people to come in. Like, there can't be a constant flow of, like, as much money as everybody brings in when they first start playing the game.
Exactly.
And I think a big piece of that is, like I said, there has been a decline, and I think overall in the war game market.
Well, so, certainly for this war game. Yeah. Warhammer Fantasy has been declining for a while, and they needed to make a roll of the dice. Whether or not this was the right decision, nobody will really know for a few months or even a few years, but they took a big chance, kind of rebranded themselves. They're not even calling it Warhammer Fantasy Blank Edition anymore. They're calling it Age of Sigmar, this new thing. And I think that the people who want to play without any of the silly rules and stuff, you can play that way.
Yeah.
And you can mm-hmm. be just kind of some 40-somethings at the game store who've been playing Warhammer Fantasy for decades, and you can still play Warhammer Fantasy. Well, except it's not called that anymore. But then also, guys who had grew up with Warhammer Fantasy and now they have some kids of their own might be like, hey, you guys can play this, and they get their kids into the game. Even ones like The Longest Beard, well, how does that appeal to kids? On a Facebook discussion, I said that's the one where the kid goes, well, Daddy, you have to buy this guy. You have to play this guy. And so you get buy-in on that level. But I think the younger audience will like the silly stuff, and I think the existing audience still can play without the silly stuff. And regardless, I think that beyond the younger audience, they're also trying to hit the audience that just wants to play for fun. They don't want a big tournament rule book. They don't want huge televised events or even money on the line. They just want to goof off. They want to throw down a bunch of little plastic mans, roll a bucket of dice, and call it a day.
I think in particular Games Workshop has either they've always wanted to have that market of the fun player, or they've been actively pursuing that market for a long time.
Yeah.
I know in my personal experience with Games Workshop, and I'm not trying to start a flame war, but I've always thought that their rules are very unbalanced and have a lot of power creep and issues like that. And this just kind of fits that mold to me. I understand people are saying that there's going to be issues with balance. And, like, I've always seen issues with balance with their particular game. So I don't see it as being that different.
Well, I think another way to look at it is kind of like a casual mindset versus mm-hmm. a competitive mindset. Like, we were talking about games like Munchkin. I don't think anyone is going to call Munchkin a competitive game in the sense that, like, I can't possibly imagine them having a Olympic event for Munchkin, you know? Like, people play chess at very high levels.
Mm-hmm.
There are games out there that you can play to a very exacting standard where you have to make every move correctly or you'll be defeated. That's not Munchkin.
Mm-hmm.
So we'll see how it pans out, but I think it's a pretty smart move.
You kind of think of it, too, as, like, the people who will start playing this game will kind of fund more of the niche, like, awesome, ultra-fan kind of games. Mm-hmm. Like, you still need that bottom line. You still have to be bringing people in, and being super, super precise and detailed might not bring just somebody off the street in.
Now, I will say I think that X-Wing does a good job of that. Like, I've seen kids play X-Wing, mm-hmm. and they play it like Age of Sigmar. They don't use the point costs. They don't use some of the, like, tournament rules. They just put some ships on the table, fly them around. They use their favorite character from the movies if they have one, and just have some fun with it. And it's very accessible. And yet that game also has high-level tournaments. It does have a tournament. What's that?
It's a thriving meta. I think it's a real tournament-style meta. It's a big deal. There's competitive lists out there.
Yeah, absolutely. And their tournaments have a lot of attendance, a lot mm-hmm. bigger in many cases than comparable tournaments. Well, certainly for Warhammer Fantasy recently.
Mm-hmm.
But part of that is the goal, the target audience that we started out talking about. Games Workshop doesn't have a big tournament format or any tournament format that they publish and try to get people to play. They're like, we're here to play for fun. That's why we exist. And that's one possible direction.
Yeah, I think what is a mark of a good game or even a good company is finding that balance of, like the X-Wing you were saying, the balance of a casual player versus the competitive player. I think they can kind of feed each other almost. If you look at Magic in particular, the mid-level guys that are going to the weekly shop tournament, they're the ones making the money for that game. It's not the high-level career pros that this is what I do for a living. They're costing more money, I think, to the game than they're giving to it. But those casual players see those high level players and say, wow, I want to be that good. And it drives the market a little bit. I think that's a really good balance of keeping the casual players interested by having a competitive scene.
Well, and if you just think about what percentage of your audience are pro players, It's such a small percentage.
Yep.
Like, no matter what game you're talking about or anything out there, like Jess was watching some of Wimbledon. Well, that's tennis.
Oh!
But, like, those players, they
like
don't
even... play outside?
Yeah, outside. Wait, with a ball.
What?
And, like, this weird, like, kind of stick thing with the net in it, and then you hit it toward the net, but not into it. Something. Anyway.
So boring. What?
But the pro players are such a tiny fraction of everyone in the world who wants to buy a tennis racket or tennis balls or whatever. It's the same with games. Your pro players are not everybody. They might be the loudest anybody's, especially on the internet, but they're not everybody.
Yeah, that I noticed that when I was running my shop, it was the kids that came in and watched the tournaments and saw what was going on. Those were the ones that went to their parents and said, hey, I want to get into this game. Give me some packs. And I had regular players that literally wouldn't spend more than the $5 for their tournament entry every week.
Right.
And it's just what drives the bottom line. And I think Warhammer or Games Workshop is banking on those kids that are interested in this fantasy world driving the game, as opposed to these established players that, like Reese said, are maybe buying one or two models every now and again.
Right. I do think, though, it is worth mentioning at least some of the criticism that's valid. Some people have stated that they really should have had a lower price point for their point of entry, because I think the point of entry product is $125. Granted, that's for two people to assemble miniatures and start playing against each other.
That's a lot of money if you don't know if you like it.
Exactly.
Like, a lot. Like, that's a big risk.
Yeah. I really feel like they should have done some $40, ideally, dollar starter pack that's just a few dudes for each person, fairly easy to assemble, and just kind of get people started with it. Like Reese said, see if they like it. They're already putting all the rules online for free. There's no rule books to buy. The main rule book's only 4 pages anyway, so you're going to have what you need to play with even just a very limited quantity of models.
Mm-hmm. Has it been confirmed that this is officially the next edition?
Yeah, officially replaces any next edition. Warhammer Fantasy is, at least for the foreseeable future, not a thing anymore.
Mm.
Age of Sigmar replaces it.
That's interesting. I mean, I feel like they've maybe hedged their bets just a little bit by not calling it Warhammer Fantasy. They still leave that door open for themselves.
Yeah.
But...
so are you saying that, like, how they used to play it will not be valid anymore in, like, tournaments and things? Like, it's not an option, like, what version you play, so to speak?
They don't really have tournaments anyway, but it's really just this is the current version of the game. This is the current edition of the game. You can always play previous editions. I remember playing various games, and when the edition changed, people were like, oh, well, I like the old one better, I'm going to stick with it. Like, I remember people saying they weren't going to go from Warhammer 40K 2nd edition to 3rd edition, but they still eventually did.
Sure.
Or War Machine. I remember people who said they wanted to keep playing War Machine 1st edition when it went over to Mark II. But I don't see anyone playing a Mark I War Machine anywhere.
I still think about it. I still want to play a Haley Turtle or a...
yeah.
Sorcerer List. I mean, I still get goosebumps about it, but...
I think role-playing games are the place where people actually do pull off the I'm not going to change sort of thing.
Well, that's a little bit easier, though, too.
It is a little easier, yeah.
It's all you focused and ran. I mean, it's a lot easier.
Mm-hmm. Because, yeah, I certainly had friends and acquaintances who refused to change from D&D 2nd edition onto 3rd, and then plenty of people never moved from 3rd onto 4th.
Oh, yeah, that's...
yeah, that's lots of people.
That do not be, speak of it.
That could be a whole episode.
We're not going to be friends after this.
No?
No, I'm just kidding. I don't know.
Which D&D do you like?
Actually, I only played D&D for a very short period of time, and then I got into Rifts and World of Darkness, and I just never went back.
Yeah.
Like, I learned my very first RPG was D&D, and I believe it was 3rd edition. Mm-hmm. And then that was it. Like, I played, I don't know, for a few months, and then I just got into other RPGs.
Yeah.
I think technically, DC, you and I have only ever played one actual game of D&D. It just happened to last for 2 years.
Together?
Well, I don't know if that's even true. Because we played little adventures and stuff at the shop.
That's true. That's true.
I think my favorite, even though it's a terrible one to have as your favorite, but I think one of my favorite D&D adventures ever was when we assigned each other what character you would play and to try and make it somebody you would hate.
Yep.
And then it was run by a kid named Max, who at the time was like 10 years old.
Okay.
And so he just found this chart, and he would roll the dice and be like, you enter a room. In the room, you see two chairs, a candle, and a goat. And then barging in are two goblins with daggers and an adult red dragon. What do you do?
He just had like a list of things.
List of things.
Just,
like, roll stuff.
Just go to the next page.
And sometimes it was like the encounter was super easy. Sometimes it was like, we can't fight that.
It's like the Mad Libs of D&D.
It was totally the Mad Libs of D&D. Yeah.
We were just playing the worst characters in the history of D&D. So bad.
Did you make each other's characters like quietly and then switch before you play?
No, we tried to pick the thing that we would like the least.
Right. And force each other to play it.
Yeah.
Interesting. Like, oh no, but so you don't have to play the one you hate the least or the most. The other person would. Is that what you're saying?
Well, what did I pick for you? I picked a virtuoso for you.
No,
because it's like the worst bard I could think of.
Yeah, yeah. Some crazy bard.
Yeah, and then you picked a verdant lord for me because you knew
a plant hippie.
Yeah.
Nice. Yeah, that fits you. That's all I've ever heard about you.
So we had these. I had the most useless bard he could imagine, and he had a plant hippie because I knew he wouldn't want to play that. But we made it work. That's the scariest part of all. We made it work.
Oh, min max, my plant purple sticky punch. He's what did it?
His druid pet was a plant. Like for real?
Yeah, not
quite for real, just in the game.
No, I know, but like, I didn't even know you could have a plant be your like companion.
Well, you're not supposed to. He was a plant druid.
It's weird.
It's pretty weird. All right, well, we have certainly hit our time, so we're gonna go ahead and wrap up. Thank you everyone for joining us, and we hope that you will join us again next week or in a couple of weeks. We also hope that you'll check out the Facebook site for Clockwork Phoenix or the webpage www.clockworkphoenixgames.com. We've got new blogs and articles going up periodically. Also soon we'll have some information on the game Stormlands, so look for that on there as well, and we will talk to you again soon. Take care.
Yay!
To contact Your Turn Next by email, send your message to contact@clockworkphoenixgames.com. Your Turn Next is copyright 2015 by its hosts and is released under the Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivatives 4.0 International License.
There are probably people out there who that's just what they do. They go to like zoos and stuff and they bring their podcasting equipment. No?
I've never seen that. I feel like security guards would be on that so fast. Like, what are you doing? What are you doing? Why are you videotaping everything?
Why are you in the tiger cage with podcast equipment?
Well, that would be just amusing.
I would listen to that.
I would too. It would be amazing and short.
All 35 seconds of it. I would
exactly.
Get down on that.